3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh yeah.
Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. until 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. It is the 28th of May, and we have a very important and special show. It is about protecting our NDIS and interrelated issues, but we just want to welcome everybody to the show, and I have Leela and Kate in the studio with me today. How are you both?
Doing good this morning, yeah. I'm particularly awake, which is very nice.
Yeah, it's always hard to sleep the night before, I always find, but I managed to get a little bit of sleep. It's a little bit of a running joke on the Thursday Breakfast crew. How about we go through the incredible show that we have on for today?
First up this morning, we're joined by Rhys Howard, Strategy and Policy Director for the First Peoples Disability Network, or FPDN. FPDN is a national organisation owned and operated by First Nations people with disability to influence public policy and advocate for the rights and interests of First Nations people and their community. This morning, Rhys helps us unpack how exclusion by design of First Nations people with disability in the latest federal budget impacts the community and increases barriers to support, and the urgent need for culturally safe systems designed and validated by community.
Next up, we'll be speaking with Nick Rose, who is the co-founder and executive director of Sustain, a network of citizen farmers and researchers, policy experts, as well as community connectors who are building sustainable food systems. We discussed the sold-out Victorian Food Policy Forum with Nick that happened last week on the 22nd of May, and some of the key findings and recommendations from Sustain's April 2026 Australian Food Security Pulse Check Survey. Then we'll just quickly chat through how food security impacts those who are multiply marginalised, including disability communities.
Amazing. And then we'll be chatting again to Andrew Bretherton, who is a disability advocate with Protect Our NDIS NAM, who joins us to discuss the importance of the NDIS, the devastating impact these proposed cuts will have on participants, loved ones, communities and broader society, as well as the upcoming government submissions deadline that has now been extended to Monday, the 1st of June, before 5 p.m. So in part one of this really moving interview that we recorded yesterday, we discussed the NDIS, how it enables participation and the fight to protect it. And in part two, we'll be talking about the need to submit as many submissions as possible, even if it's a sentence or two, and how to submit. And then lastly, we will play a segment from 3CR's Stick Together show on International Workers' Memorial Day, which was held on Tuesday, the 28th of April, 2026. It was an emotional event that marks the passing of workers who have died from work-related injuries and never came home. Annie speaks to people who have gathered to honour those who have passed, including people who have experienced a disabling workplace injury, union workers fighting for safer working conditions, and parents who continue the fight in their children's names. So it's a really, really important show focused on the NDIS, but also focused on First Nations policy and disability policy, food insecurity and workplace injuries. I just really want to highlight the submissions. And thank you so much for listening to that rundown of our show, and we'll be right back with our headlines.
The Electronic Intifada is Palestine's weapon of mass destruction.
Netanyahu's at the zenith of his genocidal career.
These people committed atrocities.
This is a war on children, essentially.
Tune into Electronic Intifada Radio for interviews, reports, and analysis. Thursdays at 7 p.m. on 8:55 a.m. 3CR Digital and online at 3cr.org.au.
This is starvation. Time is running out.
These are the news headlines for Thursday, the 28th of May. First Nations listeners, please be aware this first headline contains mention of a First Nations person who has died. You can tune back in about 1 minute if you'd like to skip this, and if you need support, you can call 13YARN on 13927676 or the Suicide Callback Service on 1300 659 467. Yesterday marked 1 year since Kumanjai White, a disabled 24-year-old Walpiri man, died after being aggressively restrained by two off-duty, plain-clothed Northern Territory police officers inside a supermarket in Mapampwe, Alice Springs. This week, Northern Territory Police announced that the police officers, who are still employed, will not be charged in relation to the death of in custody of Kumanjai White. Mr. White's family said they are heartbroken and angry over the decision. One they were made aware of when police and prosecutors showed up suddenly and unannounced, near the 1 year anniversary of Kumanjai White's death, without first seeking permission or giving notice to families. The family have long criticised the communication from Northern Territory Government and police, saying the response would have been different had Mr. White not been a Walpiri First Nations person.
Also in news this week, amidst a supposed ceasefire and as Eid al-Adha began earlier this week, Israel intensified attacks in Lebanon and Gaza. Lebanese authorities reported this week that more than 3,200 people have been killed by Israel in the past 2 months, and more than 1.6 million people have been displaced.
In related news, former International Criminal Court ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda, who served as prosecutor between 2012 and 2021, says the then head of Israel's Mossad intelligence agency pressured her in multiple meetings to drop an investigation into alleged war crimes by Israel in occupied Palestine. Bensouda said unidentified men visited her home after she opened the Israeli war crimes case in 2015, and that she interpreted the encounters as intimidation. Bensouda reported the incidents to ICC security and Dutch authorities, but no meaningful response or action took place in relation to the complaints she raised.
Finally, in headlines, 3 years after so-called Victoria ended commercial native forest logging, environment groups say the practice is returning by stealth through a new state forest byproducts framework that allows trees from public forests to be sold to timber and firewood operators under different rules. Groups including the Victorian National Parks Association and Wilderness Society warn the framework lacks independent oversight, public consultation and enforceable protections, and that it is effectively reopening loopholes for logging and land clearing in native forests. The groups are calling on the Allan Labor government to close the loopholes, introduce independent regulation and rule out any logging or timber extraction in national parks and conservation reserves. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 28th of May. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo! Good morning. This is Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and I'm in the studio with Kate and Inez. And now I welcome Rhys Howard, who is the Strategy and Policy Director for the First Peoples Disability Network, or FPDN. FPDN is a national organisation owned and operated by First Nations people with disability to influence public policy and advocate for the rights and interests of First Nations people and their community. This morning, Rhys helps me unpack how exclusion by design of First Nations people with disability in the latest federal budget increases barriers to support and the urgent need for culturally safe systems designed and validated by First Nations community. Good morning, Rhys.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we really appreciate your time, and I'm really looking forward to hearing some of your insights. So first up, for people that might not be familiar with First Peoples Disability Network, who are you and what do you do? What services do you provide?
Yeah, First Peoples Disability Network is an organisation that's been around for about 20, 25 years. So we're the national peak body for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with a disability. We're governed and led, as you said, by First Nations people with a disability. We're also a member of the Coalition of Peak under the Closing the Gap National Agreement. We do a lot of different work. We do systemic advocacy, policy development, community capacity building and government engagement at the national and international level as well. We operate the National Disability Footprint, which is our flagship Closing the Gap program, working across areas like education, housing, justice and community strengthening. We really work as the bridge between the disability sector and the First Nations sector, two systems that too often operate really in separation from each other. And we also do have some individual services such as advocacy, training and education.
Yeah, thank you for that bit of context, Rhys. It's really good to hear that it seems like FPDN is trying to have a more holistic approach, because we know that disability impacts all parts of life, including, you know, economics and housing and all those things you mentioned. Now, to start off with more context, I want to understand, what are some key concerns that have kind of been identified by FPDN that First Nations people with disability experience in day-to-day life?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And there's a lot of different components to answer, as you said. So I would say, first of all, in terms of statistics, you know, some of the best information we have, and sadly data is a problem for First Nations people with disability. They're often invisible in the data systems that capture most other people. But they experience disability at roughly twice the rate of non-Indigenous Australians. Yet they do also remain dramatically underserved, which also compounds as you go into more regional and remote areas. Some of the major concerns are underdiagnosis and misdiagnosis as well. Particularly for things like psychosocial disability, cognitive disability and FASD. And standard assessment tools across health and disability and assessment often lack the actual data that validates those tools for First Nations population. Culturally unsafe delivery of services is also a huge concern. There are many participants both inside and outside the NDIS who need to choose between culturally unsafe supports or really having no supports at all. Some of the other concerns are, you know, even in terms of NDIS providers, only 1% or less are First Nations organisations, despite about 8% of NDIS participants being First Nations. And in remote and really remote communities, more than 1 in 3 NDIS participants are not accessing the supports that are actually in their plans. And, of course, racism and other kinds of discrimination intersect in mainstream services and really remain a daily reality for a lot of people.
Yeah, okay. So it seems like there's barriers to even getting support, and then if that support happens, it might not be accessible or culturally appropriate in day-to-day life. So on the topic of the budget, which is, you know, we're looking at a system here that then trickles down into people's everyday life.
Yes.
Where does the budget systematically exclude the needs of First Nations people with disability?
Yeah, with the recent release of the budget, we were disappointed to see that there wasn't much that was new or innovative in the budget for First Nations people with disability, despite a lot of advocacy from the sector. So I think, you know, the headline of the budget obviously was largely about the NDIS. In our sector, and the savings of about $37.8 billion is built on assumptions about access to services that don't exist in many First Nations communities for people to actually transfer onto as they come off the NDIS. There's no dedicated continuing funding for the Disability Sector Strengthening Plan, which is the government's own agreed plan for building First Nations community-controlled disability services. Disability doesn't appear as a named priority in the National Indigenous Australians Agency's Closing the Gap budget fact sheet. One of the major Disability Royal Commission recommendations, which is 9.10, was to fund a national First Nations Disability Forum. So that was noted by the government at the time of release in their response. And they've also worked with us and other agencies to go through a consultation process with community and build a model. But ultimately, that proposal has not been accepted and it hasn't been funded in the actual budget. Some of the other concerns we have in terms of exclusion from the budget is that the foundational support, the system that many people will be diverted to from the NDIS as they transition off, has no cultural safety requirements built in. It has no dedicated First Nations funding, and it's years from actual delivery in remote communities if that is in fact what's going to happen. You know, all too often these reforms never reach those areas. And the investment in the new assessment tool for the NDIS called the ICAN B6 has no dedicated funding for cultural validation with First Nations communities as well. And as the primary new gatekeeper for eligibility, it's really a huge concern for people that they might be assessed by a tool that's just not appropriate.
Right. So FPDN is calling for more culturally safe and appropriate services in the NDIS amendment bill submissions. Those are open currently for people to submit feedback, experiences and thoughts. It's clear that there's a lack of these services and that's why it's being called for. Rhys, could you give some examples of culturally safe services and also explain the importance of culturally validated assessment tools like the ICAN V6?
Yeah, absolutely. And just to say, obviously, the ICAN V6 is not culturally validated at this time. And that's really what one of the things that we would encourage the government to dedicate funding and resources to. So in terms of other services that are culturally safe, obviously the real flagship for those kind of services is Aboriginal community-controlled organisations and health organisations in particular that deliver wraparound disability supports. There's fantastic examples of that happening all over the country and especially in underserved rural and remote areas where the service it really starts with governance. And when the ownership of that organisation is governed by community and it understands kinship, language and country, we see much improved outcomes for people both with and without disability. A really good example of some innovation from the NDIS was the alternative commissioning trials that came out of the NDIS independent review. Mm-hmm. So there were trials around Mornington Island and in the McDonald region, which showed that when you wrap services around community rather than sort of forcing individuals to navigate this really complex and sometimes broken kind of market-based approach, I think average planned expenditure went from around $650 to over $7,000, really revealing like the scale of what unmet demand is. Other important things that constitute a culturally safe service is when it embeds the social and emotional wellbeing model. And as we said, as I said, connection to country, kinship and cultural identity as not just add-ons, but actually central to disability support. On the new ICANN, which is being described as a functional capacity assessment, it will obviously determine who stays on the NDIS and who's removed. And if it's not culturally validated, with things like language, you know, First Nations languages for people who don't speak English as a first language in remote settings, understanding of how disability is understood and how it presents, which can be quite different for people who are First Nations, the real danger is it's systemically going to exclude mob from the NDI system, which already does sometimes happen. Standard cognitive and mental health assessment tools were designed for and validated with non-Indigenous populations largely, and they can miss this ability or misattribute it. And we see mm-hmm. this a lot, especially in justice systems, where the assessment tools are not fit for purpose. They misdiagnose so often, or they actually are just not used at all, which is even worse, despite government policy saying that they should, everyone who comes into justice settings should be assessed. One of the other really important recommendations from the Disability Royal Commission was 9.1, that recommends that culturally appropriate assessment tools must be actioned now. And we want to see that happen before the actual tool is built and deployed across the NDIS as well.
Okay, so you've mentioned remote communities a fair bit, and we know that people in regional remote areas, regardless of their cultural identity, do have less access to NDIS supports. Can you expand a bit on the impacts for First Nations people living in regional and remote communities, and maybe explain a bit more about why people wouldn't be accessing the supports in their plans?
Yeah, of course. That's a really great question. What the agency in the sector often talks about in these areas is what's called a thin market. So that's a market where there's very few providers to pick from, and sometimes none at all. We have started talking about this more in terms of the failure of the market-based approach. So for those who might not be aware, you know, NDIS really is built to facilitate a market. And what happens when you have a market-based approach is that market forces, you know, naturally apply. And so in remote areas where cost of delivery is higher because of travel, because things just cost more when you're further from large urban population centres, that naturally means less profit for providers. And it makes it, you know, in terms of a market, it's harder to serve those populations. It's less profitable. It's more complex in terms of need. And so it just, when you allow the market to choose where and when it will service participants, that kind of exclusion just naturally follows. We know that in some remote areas, less than 50% of plans are actually drawn upon by First Nations people. And we, you know, reforms that rely on people choosing between competing providers in a market are meaningless when there's no market to actually choose from. When we talk about the transition of NDIS to foundational support, it's a really concerning. The minister himself actually acknowledged that the services that people would be diverted to were unfortunately too often dismantled, and really in remote First Nations communities, many of those never existed in the first place. So to bring them back is a little bit of a paradox. There's also workforce issues when you're talking about rural and really remote areas. So studies show there's an additional estimated 13,000 disability workers are needed by 2031. And the annual turnover of those workers is about 20% as well. And as far as we're aware, you know, there's no solid plan, solid funding for that workforce to be developed for First Nations people. All of these different factors, including things like transport, housing and digital connectivity barriers, they really compound every other access barrier. It makes for a really, really difficult environment for someone who has a disability in a remote location who is First Nations and just can't access the supports that they need. What then happens, of course, is that they use less of their available funding. It looks to the agency like they don't need that extra funding, and then, you know, their plan can be reduced. And we would just like to see the government consider more innovative models, like suggested in the DRC and the NDIS review, of things like alternative commissioning, so that those services exist where they're most needed.
Yeah, thank you for that, Rhys. Now, to wrap up today, I just wanted to turn our focus back onto people out there, mob out there, who are currently on NDIS or trying to apply for NDIS.
Mm.
How could someone get advocacy support from First Peoples Disability Network to either help with their application, help with a reassessment process, or do something like make a submission to the NDIS amendment bill?
Yeah, great question. So obviously the first place to have a look at is our website, which has a lot of information on your rights, our policy work, community resources, and how to connect. So that's at fpdn.org.au. You can give us a call as well. Our phone number's on the website. And we have a national office. We can connect people with relevant supports and referrals. So obviously we have an advocacy service that sits within FPDN. Mm-hmm. We also have strong links to other state-based advocacy services as well. So each state funds disability advocacy, and the quality of those services can vary, but we will be with you there on that journey if you need to engage with services. You can also follow us, obviously, on social media for updates on all things FPDN and First Nations disability rights and policy and community engagement opportunities. So we're on Instagram, Facebook, we're also on LinkedIn. If you're a First Nations person with disability, a family member, carer, community organisation, you're really welcome to engage with any of our capacity building programs and get in touch if you're interested to talk to us.
Rhys, thank you so much for joining us today. We really value hearing you unpack all that for us, and we hope that you can join us again.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for having me.
Bye. You just heard from Rhys Howard, Strategy and Policy Director for the First Peoples Disability Network. And this morning, Rhys helped us unpack how the exclusion by design of First Nations people with disability in the 2026-27 federal budget increases barriers to support that are already very prevalent for First Nations people, and also reinstates the urgent need for culturally safe systems designed and validated by community. I want to drop food, not bombs. Hot trains, bottles, give it every info shop. I want to give free therapy out in the park. Go to free school, jumps, tie, crack, spark, drop food, not bombs. When I was new to Melbourne, I found a food, not bombs flyer on the road, and I had like this fist with a carrot, and carrots are my favourite vegetable. Yeah, I think they were asking for help doing stuff, and I got in touch.
I guess rescue food
that would otherwise go to waste.
I like the aspect of sharing food and not making anyone feel obligated to pay anything for it.
We make a real point at Food Not Bombs of involving everyone who wants to be involved in whichever part they want to be involved in.
For more information, go to fnbmelb.noblogs.org. Food Not Bombs is a 3CR supporter.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Arnica Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. You're listening to our very important Protect Our NDIS and Related Issues show today. And now we are joined by Nick Rose, who is the co-founder and executive director of Sustain, a network of citizen farmers, researchers, policy experts and community connectors building sustainable food systems. We discussed the sold-out Victorian Food Policy Forum last week and the key findings and recommendations from Sustain's Check Pulse survey and how food insecurity impacts those who are multiply marginalised. Thanks so much, Nick, for coming on the show.
Great to be with you, Inez and Kate.
Hi, Nick. It's Kate here. Super quickly before we get started, I just wanted to let you know that I volunteered at Oak Hill Food Justice Farm and it was an incredible experience just for our audience to know. So thank you for providing those opportunities.
That's fantastic. I'm so glad to hear that, Kate.
To get started, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the work that Sustain does.
So we are a health promotion charity and social enterprise that is working to transform Victoria's and Australia's food systems from ones that are harmful to people and ecosystems and really oriented to maximise corporate profit to ones that enable flourishing human communities and ecological systems. And that's what we believe needs to happen. That work is urgent for all kinds of reasons, and that's why we exist.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you so much, Nick, and for explaining, how important the work that you do is. I know that Sustain has recently conducted the Food Security Pulse Check Survey and participated in the Victorian Food Policy Forum. What were the main findings from each of these initiatives?
So, obviously, we're in a time of heightened crisis at the moment for all kinds of reasons, particularly in 2026 with the launch of the unprovoked war by Israel and the United States against Iran at the end of February that led, as we know, to a sharp spike in oil prices and lots of concerns about what the impacts would be over the coming months and well into next year if that conflict wasn't resolved quickly, which, as we know, it has not been. So we wanted to do a pulse check, really, to understand what our audience and those of allied organisations were thinking and feeling and what people were doing. So this was the Food Security Pulse Check Survey that ran through April. We had 676 respondents. And the main findings were that these respondents were really concerned about the rising oil prices impacting food affordability, i.e. the cost of food, either for themselves or for other people. So we had nearly 45% of respondents saying that they were extremely concerned about that. And then similarly, the respondents were very worried about the potential impact on food availability in terms of possible shortages or disruptions if the crisis continued and worsened. And then we asked people what they were actually doing. This is as of April 2026. And overwhelmingly, over 84% of respondents said they were already making changes to their purchasing behaviours or eating behaviours. So over 60% said they were looking for more specials and discounts. Over 40% said they were eating out less. Over 30% they were buying more non-perishable foods in bulk. Concerningly, over a quarter, 26%, said they were eating cheaper foods more frequently, which is an indicator of rising food insecurity. A quarter said they were growing more of their own food at home. 25% also said they joined a food co-op buying group or home delivery service like Box Divi. And then also concerningly, 4% said they were skipping meals more often, which is an indicator of severe food insecurity. So those were the sorts of changes that people said they were already making. And then we asked them what their recommendations were for the federal government with the developing of the National Food Security Strategy at the moment, Feeding Australia. We gave people six options, and there was strong support for all of them, but particularly to support and incentivise Australian farmers to transition to lower input and sustainable forms of production. One of the main issues to do with the closure of the Strait of Hormuz is the fact that it is a major supplier of nitrogen-based fertiliser, urea. Australia gets something like 60% of its urea fertiliser from that one source, from the Gulf, and the price of fertiliser has gone up really sharply. So respondents are aware that there's been a movement for many years in Australia towards regenerative agriculture and agroecology, using biological fertilisers, using legumes and cover crops, and really working with the soil to maintain and sustain soil fertility and yields. And that's what this group of respondents were really saying should be a top priority for the federal government, is to really, you know, fast track that process and support farmers to make those transitions so we're not caught in this situation in the future. Secondly, to tackle concentrations of power in the Australian food system, such as the supermarket duopoly. Thirdly, to impose a windfall tax on gas exports or other taxes to fund these emergency responses and other measures. Then to increase levels of welfare benefits to raise the rate of job seeker above the poverty line. And then finally, to support community members to work with local governments and community organisations to develop their own community food security and food resilience plans and actions. And finally, to support more people to grow food at home. So all those measures got strong levels of support, but particularly the first two. And then in comments, a respondent talked about the fact that food should be seen as a basic human right and addressed through that framework. Comments like food security should not be dependent on the business model of a couple of the duopoly supermarkets. The system is too important to be subject to the purpose of making profit for shareholders of Woolworths and Coles. Make community gardens available for people in rentals and or apartments. And then comments like this: food is a need for life, like oxygen and water. Everyone deserves access to good quality fresh food, and especially in Australia, No one should be going hungry. So those are all really, really important points. Those were some of the key messages from our survey. And then at the forum on Friday, we had, as you mentioned, it was sold out. We had 150 people from across the food system attending. It was a really positive day. We had panels on First Nations food sovereignty, on really fantastic community-led food security initiatives like Farm My School in the Colac Otway Peninsula, like the Just Food Collective, Community Plate, the Community Grocer, Yarra Valley ECOS. There's so many organisations across Melbourne and across the state that are doing really wonderful work and have been for years to support their communities to access good food. So it was a real acknowledgement and sharing of all that leadership. Mm-hmm. But at the end, we spent about an hour and a half in small groups talking about what attendees wanted from the federal and state government to strengthen food security in Australia. And, you know, some very clear messages came through, reinforcing several of those that I already mentioned with the survey, such as lifting the level of welfare benefits, stronger oversight of supermarket pricing and market concentration, supporting farmers to make that shift to regenerative agriculture through forms of direct support, having integrated policy and governance, so that would be requiring all local governments to develop food policies and strategic plans with communities, reforming our planning schemes to prioritise healthy food access, local food systems, community food infrastructure, using the lever of public procurement, for example, with the aged care, the money that's spent on food in the aged care system.
Yeah, exactly. I know that we are just running out of time. There's so many amazing things to talk about. I know that you've spoken about the aged care, and the focus of our show is on the NDIS amendment bill.
We were wondering, Nick, so if you could just help us understand something. So this week, our show, as Ines said, is focusing on the Senate inquiry into the proposed NDIS amendment bill, as the submission period for this inquiry is set to close next Monday. A recent food bank hunger report found that an exceptionally high 67% of households across Australia that included either someone with a disability or health issue had experienced food insecurity. We were just wondering if in any of your recent work, if you found any similar findings, and how you think recent NDIS cuts are going to affect these figures of food insecurity.
Well, it's going to make it worse. I think that's the clear message from those working in this sector. The NDIS cuts are taking away essential supports that people living with disabilities really need, and that includes support for dietitian advice. Dietitians Australia were already talking about this last year with funding cuts for allied health services, and with the even more severe cuts that are taking place right now, it is going to push increasing numbers of people living with disability into reliance on the emergency food relief system and into food insecurity. So, yeah, it's a really retrograde step that unfortunately the federal government is taking.
Yeah, and yeah, thank you for acknowledging that, Nick, and outlining it so clearly. We know, from the work that you've outlined and we've shared today, food insecurity impacts so many people, and as you've said, we're hearing across the board that people are skipping meals to afford their medication, to afford their rent. It is such a really horrific time to exist in this cost of living crisis and sustain yourself. But on that, how can people get involved and find out more about Sustain?
Yeah, thank you very much. So if people want to get involved in our work, we're building a statewide and national community of food system change makers through the Australian Food Network platform. So you can become a member and connect with hundreds of other people who are passionate about these issues and working on them for both immediate sort of local action and change happening right now, and then for advocacy at federal and state levels to really get the structural reforms that we need to address this crisis. So if you go to sustain.org.au and look at network, you can find out how to get involved and stay in touch with us.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Nick. And we'll have all of that in our show notes as well. But I hope you have a really good day. And thank you so much for your time and expertise today.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Inez and Kate.
And that was Nick Rose, the co-founder and executive director of Sustain, a network of citizen farmers, researchers, policy experts and community connectors building sustainable food systems. We discussed the sold-out Victorian Food Policy Forum last week, Friday, and the key findings and recommendations from Sustain's April 2026 Food Security Pulse Check Survey, and how food insecurity impacts those who are multiply marginalised, including disability communities. And before that, we heard from Rhys Howard, Strategy and Policy Director of First Peoples Disability Network. And now you'll hear my conversation in two parts with Andrew Bretherton, the disability advocate with Protect Our NDIS, NAM, who joins us to discuss the importance of the NDIS, the devastating impact that these proposed cuts will have on participants, on loved ones, on communities and broader society, as well as the upcoming government submissions, which have been now extended to this Monday, the 1st of June, before 5 p.m. So in this first part, we'll discuss the NDIS, how it enables participation in the community and the fight to protect our NDIS. Thanks so much, Andrew, for joining us here today on 3CR Thursday Breakfast. I know it's a really difficult time for so many disabled people, and the work that Protect Our NDIS is doing is so, so vital. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about what is Protect Our NDIS and a little bit about yourself?
Protect Our NDIS is a group of grassroots disability communities and advocates that have come together nationally to fight the cuts that were proposed by Mark Butler and Labor, I think a few weeks ago now. We've just been busy trying to organize people around the country to get involved in the protests. Really important at the moment is to get these submissions to Senate estimates, the Senate hearing, to try and fight and stop the cuts that have been proposed that I believe will give significant harm to the community. Oh, and yeah. About myself?
Yes, about yourself.
Yeah. So I think I'm the media liaison for Protect Our NDIS in Melbourne. And I'm a member of Disability Rights and Culture. I'm also the convener for Accessible Victorian Greens and organiser at Call for Change Australia.
Yeah, amazing. I know you've been on our show a few times already, and just really, yeah, I want to thank you for your time and your expertise. Yeah, I know with Protect Our NDIS and the communities and being the media liaison, what have you been hearing from disabled people and communities about the proposed cuts?
Oh, look, there is a lot of concern, fear, and worry about the cuts. Some of the major concerns are, well, we don't even know who's going to be cut or by what criteria. I don't think Labor or Butler hasn't been very clear on who is going to be on the receiving end of these cuts or how they're going to determine who gets cut from the scheme or in what category. And also the kind of lack of supports to go into if people are cut or do have their plans reduced, because a lot of the state programs were removed or discontinued when the NDIS was rolled out. And with Thriving Kids and foundational supports in particular, they haven't been really clear on what these are, and they haven't really been clear on how they've been, if or even if they are co-designed. And from able-bodied people, we're hearing a bit of fear about the economy. I think there's about 200,000 jobs that will potentially be lost by these cuts and $67 billion kind of ripped from the economy. So in my view, this is kind of like a economic time bomb that Labor hasn't really explained how they're going to make up for that loss of jobs and loss of money from the economy.
Yeah, thank you for explaining that. And a lot of it doesn't seem to make sense, and how uncertain it is, it leaves everybody in a state of like fear and paranoia as well. And yeah, I guess I don't really understand how disabled people and their communities are being the targets. I feel like there's a lot of misinformation out there. What would you like to say just to like clear up some of the misinformation that you've been seeing or hearing? There's a lot of myths going on right now.
Yeah, well, we've got to remember Labor did pay Redbridge, I think, almost $500,000 for this disinformation campaign.
What does Redbridge mean?
They were a Redbridge marketing team. So that's the name of the company. Labor had reached out and paid this marketing company on, you know, how best can we sell cutting and gutting the NDIS? And they did some focus groups and stuff and came back and found, well, look, if we frame it around frauds and rorts, the Australian public will kind of eat this up and justify the cuts. It's a bit ridiculous because I think the reported fraud in the NDIS is much less than what we have in Medicare. Same with rorting too. But what this bill doesn't do is crack down on what it says its intention is. Instead, it's just cutting participants' funding or removing participants from the scheme. If they're serious about rorting and fraud, they wouldn't be locking us into only using registered providers, because disabled people have consistently reported it is the major registered providers that are doing the most rorting of the scheme or charging the most insane amounts for minimum service or minimum items. So if they want to crack down on these things, why aren't they putting in measures that actually crack down on those things, like strengthening safeguards commissions, strengthening the ACCC, the tax office, having criminal convictions for people found of fraud? And one of the things that has been concerning is there are participants that are worried that they will have debts raised against them by the government, so similar to a robo-debt type of thing on their plans. But this will be much worse than robo-debt because it could lead to deaths, suicide, self-harm. I don't know why they're coming after participants for that money rather than
exactly
the providers. So none of their bill actually attacks what they say they're going to attack. All it does is attack disabled people and their communities and allies.
Yeah, and mentioning robo-debt is so important because we lost so many people similar with the NDIS. Like, this is life or death. It's already hard enough to get on the NDIS. To stay on it, we have to like continuously prove that you still have a disability. It's all kind of ridiculous. But I guess for people who don't know what the NDIS is, why is it so important? You know, especially for people who are multiply marginalized.
Yeah. And I'd like to add to that too, because with robo-debt, yes, it did lead to deaths. And with the NDIS bill, we also have that added kind of increased discrimination because of some of the media reporting around this, but also segregation from the community. So if you remove this funding, you're segregating large parts of the disability community from engaging with the rest of the community. They're not being overt about it, but they are being covert in removing the funding. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, disabled people can be seen but not heard. I'll answer the rest of your question, but if you could please repeat it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
A bit of a tangent. Yeah.
No, not at all. I think all of what you're saying is so important. I think a lot of our listeners maybe are NDIS participants or maybe know somebody or are disability support workers themselves. But I guess for people who don't know, like, how does the NDIS benefit somebody? And particularly for people who are multiply marginalized, like, it's not just appointments and doctors. What else is the NDIS supporting people? As you said, like connecting to community and their well-being.
Well, it's also helping getting people into employment. I think it was more than 10,000 people were able to go back into employment after getting onto the NDIS. And that's another one of those economic markers that aren't being measured by Labor with these cuts. For me personally, before getting on the NDIS, I was a lot more unwell. I was a lot more house and bed bound. And the only thing that has been able to be changed in my life is having that NDIS funding to get like an electric wheelchair or to get support workers at home to help me conserve energy and be able to do things like what I'm doing now, advocacy or going out and connecting with my community or, you know, giving advice to government. Or, you know, it enriches the community so much. It's not just, look, here's funding and help with your disability. It's also providing economic benefits. It's providing health benefits. We're taking a lot of the burden off the hospital kind of system with the NDIS and other community health programs and systems. And it removed a lot of the institutionalization of disabled people. So before, we did have, unfortunately, a lot of disabled people that were stuck in nursing homes with people way outside their generation and age brackets and not being able to connect with their community and stuff. And NDIS funding meant that, you know, they could have their own place, have their own independence. And to certain people, it meant getting out of abusive situations in institutions, but also out of perhaps abusive relationships with partners or family. But with this cuts coming through, it may mean they have to make the hard choice of going back into those abusive situations. And, you know, DV is really not taken seriously in this country, even more so when it's towards a disabled person.
We've spoken a little bit about how important it is. And I know there are certain, you know, populations where like regional and remote participants and, you know, LGBTIQA plus participants, people experiencing family or domestic violence.
A homelessness too.
Homelessness, exactly. Yeah. What might happen if people cannot get NDIS supports anymore?
Sorry.
Oh, Andrew, we don't have to do this question.
No, it's okay. I just had a friend that was in this situation that had cuts and self-harmed and, you know, almost lost their life and stuff. I can't really talk about it too much, but the previous cuts were already having an impact on people. And I know for me, before I got on the scheme, I was experiencing homelessness and hospitalization, and it kind of petrifies me that I may end up in that situation again if I do have a cut in funding and lack of access to supports. Like, Labor's treating the NDIS as their own personal little piggy bank, but all they're doing is moving deck chairs on the Titanic. They think, oh, if we remove this amount of money from the NDIS and we give it to hospitals, then, you know, that's going to be a economic good. But all they're doing is they're moving disabled people from individualized care to clogging up the hospital system. So we're not really going to feel the effect of that original cut of the $21 billion before this previous set of cuts was announced. And I've said this a lot in a lot of other things that I've done with disability advocacy, is they're putting a dollar value on access. And what that does is it says, look, you cost too much and we believe you're not worth this cost. And it's a form of democide where people will end up self-harming or end up in situations where their life is at grave risk or in abusive situations and have nowhere to go. And as I was saying earlier, the services that were in place, that disabled people campaigned so hard to escape from, those old state services, and it was fantastic that we got rid of them. We don't even have those services anymore to go back to. At a very minimum, you would think the government would set those services up at the state level first before proceeding with the cuts, but they're not. And if you're in a state like Queensland, I think the Liberal government there hasn't even committed to spending anything to replace those services. So, you know, they're choosing profit over people, and there are other economic triggers they could go after, like taxing the 1%, taxing our resources fairly, taxing gas companies, taxing wealth, not work. They've basically just said, look, we don't think your life has value, so we're going to remove this funding, which is crazy because we're also seeing them do this to the aged care sector, and they're attacking the communities that are the most vulnerable or that they've identified have the least amount of resistance of fighting back.
Yeah. Do you want to take a second, Andrew?
No, it's okay. I can go.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to 3CR Thursday Breakfast on the 28th of May, and we're having a very specialised program for protecting our NDIS, really encouraging upcoming government submissions, which have been extended to this Monday, the 1st of June, before 5 p.m. You don't have to be an NDIS participant to make a submission. It can be just your thoughts. It can literally be a sentence or two. I know it's not entirely accessible, but having the number of submissions is really, really, really important. And we're speaking to Andrew Bretherton, the disability advocate for Protect Our NDIS, who has gone through how important the NDIS is and the devastating impact that these proposed cuts will have. And now in part two, you will hear why it's so important to submit, encouraging others to submit, and how you can do this. Yeah, Andrew, I'm really, very moved and, really hurt alongside so many so many people, and to be treated as disabled people as like a dollar value and a profit margin is so dehumanizing. I don't know if people really understand how violent and pervasive ableism is and institutionalization. Like, disability is in every single facet of our lives, and we can't be the only people fighting for this. I need everybody listening to tell everybody else to join in. Disabled people have such a long and beautiful and strong history, as you've mentioned, of resistance and solidarity. We need to be in solidarity together. And I guess coming up now to the submissions, there's a submission and there's a petition, which are two separate actions, but the submission it has now been extended to Monday, the 1st of June. So we have like an extra time over the weekend. Can you tell us a little bit more about, yeah, why it is so important to make this submission?
Oh, thank you, oh generous government, for giving us 3 extra days to make
literally yeah.
It's ridiculous. They only gave us two weeks to make these submissions, and again, disabled people are being asked to share their personal experience, their lived stories. We did all of this during the Disability Royal Commission, and that was also promptly ignored by Labor. They didn't even implement like 5% of the recommendations from the Royal Commission. We're being asked again to give our stories and our experiences and responses, and most likely going to be ignored unless some people in the Labor government start to grow a spine and oppose these cuts. It's exhausting for disabled people to do this. Like,
yes,
it is so tiring to have to keep telling your story again and again and again and have it routinely ignored. But yeah, I should actually talk about how to make a submission.
We'll also have that in our show notes. We've been posting a little bit about it, but I know it doesn't have to be very detailed. It can literally be a sentence or two. The main thing is we need the number of submissions. So yeah, there's like templates that we can share. Yeah, if you don't have an account with the APH government, just need to make one, you just upload it. Important. Is there anything else that you'd like to share about the submission process?
Well, it's also really important that they haven't made this accessible for everyone, the Disability Royal Commission. At least with Disability Royal Commission, you could call in on certain lines if you couldn't write a submission. You could do a face-to-face thing where they had to listen to your submission and all of that. That isn't happening with this. So what we need to do, even if you can only get a few words out, or just follow a template. I think Babes with Mobility Aids, she has a great guide on how to do a short, medium, and long submission. I think on the Protect Our NDIS pages, we've also got some guides on how to make a submission as well. But it's just important that we make some type of submission. If you think it's just for disabled people, no. We need all our able-bodied allies to make submissions as well and talk about the job losses, the economic impacts, how it will impact your daily life, the business losses that will happen from these changes as well. A lot of that stuff and the impact on able-bodied people is being ignored, because this comes back to what you're saying before, and I think this is the attitude with the ableism, is a lot of people think, oh, well, it will never happen to me. I'll never become disabled. But you very rarely go through your entire life without being impacted by disability in some way, yourself or someone you love or someone close to you. And what Labor's saying with this bill is we're going to choose who's worthy or disabled enough, inverted commas, to receive support and deny anyone else the help that they need. But for able-bodied people, this should be viewed as something like aged care, because, you know, if one day you do come out of work and say you get struck by a car, or you get a lot of people got long COVID from the COVID disease and had their lives changed completely overnight. Thank God we have something like the NDIS to support us and be there for those working Australians to catch us if we get a disability. Just like with aged care, we will eventually all get old and need support. It's the same with disability. So they're removing that safeguard for able-bodied people if that happens. And what they're saying is we're going to leave that to you to spend your entire savings, and we're not going to support you anymore, which is very inherently ableist and not what Labor promised us in 2022. So it's very important everyone make a submission, talk about how it's going to impact you, how it might impact the economy, because I think with all those job losses, unemployment's going to rise. The NDIS generates, I think, almost $2.30 for every dollar spent. So it is a net economic good. All of that money gets reinvested and it generates more money in disabled people getting more jobs, more local businesses being made, and more workers being able to, you know, work in the economy. In a way, disabled people are the means of production. We just don't own that means of production.
Even if you're not yet disabled, regardless, you should care about people in your community that matter, not because, like, not just you won't be not yet disabled, but like these disabled lives matter, and they don't just matter, they should be supposed to thrive and be involved in community and have supports just like anybody else. And I think people also forget, as you said, there's long COVID, there are people who have had workplace injuries, who have had to be on NDIS. Like, you just don't know what will happen, but regardless, you should still care about disabled people. And
well, our lives have matter, and, you know, we might have the next Einstein or the next Rembrandt or something that's from the disability community that can't access that potential because they don't have the support or the funding to enable that to happen.
Yeah. And not just for, like, excellence, but, like, just for themselves. Like, imagine if, like, how many people are, like, I would really love to write or make music or facilitate a session. Like, there's so many incredible things that everybody deserves to have enriched and supported. And yeah, I know it's a really, really scary time, and there is nothing besides solidarity and action and, yeah, doing stuff like this to really promote it. But a lot of people are not okay. Is there anything that you would like to say to those who are listening?
Look, we need to build community and build our little pockets of resistance, and we need our able-bodied allies there standing with us. And I'm looking at you, unions, I'm looking at you, certain NDIS businesses that have made a lot of bloody money off our backs. It's time for you guys to actually stand up and stand with us and hear the mantra of nothing about us without us, because you guys not only have the strongest voices, but you have the resources to help us with this as well. And it's a bit sad that some of these organizations or unions and work community groups and stuff aren't doing enough to speak up, probably because they're scared of reparations from the government or other things. Political parties too, you need to get off your ass and do more than what you're doing. Yeah, so we need to build community, build our pockets, join things like Protect Our NDIS in your local city. You know, you could join Accessible Working Greens or with your local disability advocacy group like Disability Rights and Culture or Belong. We have to make our voices so strong and so fierce that they never will even try to pull something like this on us again. And maybe in the next phase is disrupting. We need to disrupt the able-bodied medical model so it makes it more impossible for this type of stuff to happen, which is through protests and other disruptive actions like boycotts and that kind of thing, and calling out some of these ministers. Because Labor loves to call themselves the great ally of the disability community. Labor. They always take credit for, well, we implemented the NDIS. Okay, cool. But that same year you implemented the NDIS, you also put in disability scales to the DSP to make it harder for people to access the disability pension. You voted against marriage equality for disabled people earlier this year. They aren't an ally to the disability community, and we need to hold them accountable. And part of doing that is not voting for these systems that put it in place, you know. Use your voice, use your vote, build community, build those little networks of resistance, build those little networks of support.
Nothing about us without us. We'll have all the information on how to submit. That is extended until 1st of June, which is Monday before 5 p.m. We will have all the information on how to do that. But thank you so much again, Andrew, for coming on the show.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you.
Thank you. And that was our two-part interview with Andrew Bretherton, who's a disability advocate with Protect Our NDIS NAM, who joined me to discuss the importance of the NDIS, the devastating impact that these proposed cuts will have, which we cannot stress are going to be monumental on loved ones, participants, the community, broader society, and how important it is to get those submissions in before Monday, the 1st of June. And please encourage others to do so. And yeah, it can literally just be a sentence or two, but it's really important just to have those numbers. And we'll be right back with the last segment of our show.
Hi, my name's Fionn. I'm from VALID, the Victorian Advocacy League for Individuals with Disability. We're the leading advocacy organisation for people with intellectual disability in Victoria. We're holding our annual winter conference called Advocacy in Action on the 22nd and 23rd of June at the Novotel in Bell Street, Preston. Advocacy in Action will have a strong focus on the NDIS and the changes being pushed by the federal government, which are causing huge concern for people with disabilities and their families and supporters. Advocacy in Action will involve 2 days of discussion, sharing information and planning action to make sure any changes to the NDIS are safe and positive for people with disabilities. Please come and join us. You can find out more at our website at valid.org.au.
This is Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And Inez, that interview with Andrew was just so powerful. It really moved me. And I wanted to say a few words from my experience. I'm a support worker and I'm also someone that experiences the disabling effects of the colonial capitalist system myself. So, you know, working with other disabled people and being part of that community, that's actually the only way I have found an accessible job that I'm able to maintain and keep and be valued and respected in. And so each time there is cuts to NDIS or major changes, it affects, the ripple effect is just massive. And even people that you might not notice, you know, that you're living so in connection with people living with disability until something drastic like this happens. But yeah, I just wanted to say as well that we are sticking together in this and I have so much respect for, oh yes, shout out sticking together, our next segment. But I have so much respect for all the people on NDIS and people living with a disability who might not have supports, who have been surviving and thriving and being able to love through all of the chaos.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Leela. That was so moving and important. And, you know, we've really talked about First Nations disability. We've talked about food insecurity, protecting NDIS, making submissions, and what it's like, yeah, what it means to have an accessible job and be a disability support worker and be in community with other people. And lastly, as Leela said, sticking together, we're playing a segment from 3CR's Stick Together show, Stick It Together, on International Workers Memorial Day, held on Tuesday the 28th of April. And it's an emotional event that marks the passing of workers who died from workplace related injuries. And even though in these interviews that Annie has done with the people that attended, they don't use the word disability, but everything they are describing is, yeah, OHS. They're also describing systemic barriers, grief, and I think they have so much to say, and I think it's a really important interview. And we talk to people who've experienced a disabling workplace injury, union workers fighting for safer working conditions, and parents who continue the fight in their children's names.
In Melbourne, we are under autumnal trees as leaves flutter to the grass in a garden close to Victoria Trades Hall. First, we hear from some of the people who gathered to honour the dead, followed by the Victorian Premier, Jacinta Allen, then from Lana Cormey, now part of a group with lived experience of loss working to change the system, and ending with some of the remembrances of those who never returned home from work. Yeah, why are you here today?
George, it's just paying respect to what it is to the people who've died unnecessarily on their workplaces. And it's hopefully the flag and a remembrance of them, but also the flag to what it is going forward, that we work in dangerous industries and I know once you go to work and I come home.
Have you had experience of this at your workplaces?
Yeah, I have over the years, yeah, in construction, so it is. There's guys that went to work, and it's the biggest industry, I believe, in the country, that in agriculture, so it is for deaths in workplaces. So it is, and I think it should always be held and is the number one priority of everything else.
One of the things that makes unions important, isn't it?
It is, really. That's what we're there for. We're there to protect the membership and to make sure that they get a decent wage, a decent standard of living, so it is, and that they go home safely from work, and even while they're at work, they're in a safe environment, so it is, and that's given top priority.
Preethiar, our Stick Together show, so I'm interested in why you've come to the Memorial for Workers.
Look, it's a very important day for every worker, and not only the union movement, but the community, because unfortunately today we still have too many people who go to work and don't come home. Society just seems to think it's almost, the way it is, and that's just the way it's going to be, and we need to remember those people.
Just an accident.
Yeah, that's right. It's just part of normal day society, and unfortunately that's not the case, and we need to keep doing this to remind people that, when people go to work, they deserve to come home to their families and friends, and, there needs to be a lot of focus on making sure that does happen, and, it's sad. A lot of these people that have passed away at work, personally, I don't believe in anything as an accident. When someone is seriously injured or killed, it's because something that should have been in place wasn't, or people weren't provided adequate training. And the industries that we represent workers, we're seeing a lot of that. And the employers just seem to replace, injured workers or workers who have deceased with somebody else, and business as usual.
You're from the TWU.
Yeah.
You have a high level of injury and death.
The industry that we represent workers in is recognised as one of the most dangerous. So, in the aviation space, road transport, the pressure on workers to just go, take shortcuts. Employers turn a blind eye to that. But then when someone's injured or killed, again, there's just no accountability.
One of the things about OH&S is that, one, like you said, if there's a regulation or a rule, it's usually because something really diabolical has happened, right?
Well, that's very reactive, and I think there needs to be, an overall review of the whole system, because we shouldn't wait for somebody to be killed, for employers, the industry, the regulators to react. It's too late at that stage. And so, there needs to be a lot more focus on the proactive roles that we play. Our employers today still generally see us raising health and safety issues as an attack, and it's not. We're actually raising these issues in order to try and prevent their employees, members of ours, from getting injured or killed. So, that whole education piece, that whole emphasis on being proactive rather than reactive, and just making it accountable, because I know there are manslaughter laws, but I'm yet to see one employer who's gone to jail. And so the system just has failed these poor people who have gone to work and haven't come home.
It is actually a demarcation in the class struggle, really, isn't it? Safety at work.
Master-servant system's always been in place, and unfortunately, industry today just replace a dead worker with a healthy worker until something happens to them. So, there's no consideration for accountability. There's no fear. It's horrible. It's terrible.
And words are cheap. We're so sorry.
We all see employers with their lovely laminated flyers and posters and all the information up on notice boards about safety being a priority. But you're right. They talk the talk, but they don't walk the walk.
I'm from 3CR. In fact, I might have talked to you before.
You may have.
Yeah, because I remember you were telling me the story of how you got to be in the wheelchair.
That's right, yes. Yeah, I had a workplace accident when I was in my 20s. And, I've been in a wheelchair for, over 30 years now.
Yeah, so you've got skin in the game when it comes to Memorial Day.
I sure do, and that's what I love about these days. I mean, as much as it's, a bit of a sombre day, it draws a bit of attention to workplace safety, workplace injury and workplace fatality. So I love coming along and just listening to the different speakers, and And even some of the politicians have got some, you know, some interesting views on how we can make things safer for all workers.
One of the things that I find inspiring about you, I guess, is that you also coming here to show us that a real person is really affected and has the guts to tell everybody about their journey as well as how we need to do stuff.
That's right. You know, in a lot of cases, when someone has a serious workplace injury, you know, they get through the hospital and medical treatment and then a bit of rehab, but then, you know, they you don't see them again, you know. Yeah. So it's good. And I mean, look, I was one of the lucky ones. I had some good people around me at the time, some good family support. And my dad pretty much said, look, you know, there's not much you can do about it. Just get on with your life. And I think that's, you know, that's been good for me. It's allowed me to, as much as I don't like the fact that I get around in a wheelchair, I'm still here. I've had 30 years of life that I could have missed out on.
Also, contribution.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, we can all contribute to society. It doesn't matter, you know, what circumstance you're in. You know, we've all got something to give. And if you can give a little bit of something of yourself, it's pretty rewarding.
What sort of work do you do now?
Well, I believe it or not, I actually share my story with other workplaces. So I turn up at a workplace and I say, look, guys, this is what happened, and girls, this is what happened to me. Don't let it happen to you. So I give people a real personal insight into, you know,
the spin of the dime.
Yeah. The realities of getting hurt while you're doing your job.
Yeah. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'm from 3CR. I'm from Stick Together Show. So I'm wondering why it's important to be here today.
Okay. Well, I represent Grief Work, and we support families after a work-related fatality. So it's important to be here to acknowledge those that have died at work.
And their families.
And their families. And we're particularly, what's important is the aftercare of families after a work-related fatality.
Yeah. What's your experience of people's journey?
Well, I personally lost my son in a work accident 30-odd years ago. And I founded Grief Work with John Bottomley, who's a Uniting Church minister. The journey of the families is a long one because of the issue around the length of time for work cover prosecutions and coroner inquiries. And that grief gets re-triggered over and over again during that 6 to 7 years sometimes when families are going through the court system. It's a huge loss, and, you know, particularly for kids, all those milestones that are never met with dad not being there, all of those things.
Yeah. So do you have, with families, do you continue the relationship over a long length of time?
Absolutely, absolutely. Some of them are 7 or 8 years down the track and still connected to grief work.
Well, I'm here. My name's Brett Strews. I'm the co-chair of the WIC, which is the Workplace Investigative Consultative Committee. And I also lost a son in a workplace incident. So I'm here to support the people and the families who have lost loved ones.
And
so,
also, I suppose, to stand in their place.
Yes, exactly right. Yeah, it's a great day that they have this, to try and remember the people. As we're talking, I was actually one of Beth's clients as well, so that's how I've got to know her. She's on the committee with me as well, so we're all lost loved ones, and we know the experience it has on people. The WIC committee I'm on, we're very big on workplace safety, and we look at how we can improve things to help people and ensure it doesn't happen again, because since 2018, nearly 700 people have died in Victoria from workplace incidents. That's nearly over 70 a year. That's horrendous.
That's a lot.
Yeah, so we're not seeing it going down.
No.
And that's horrendous.
I've been with Grief Work so we founded it just on 30 years, and the numbers are consistent each year. It's anywhere between 60 and 70 a year, and that's too many.
And also in the same industries?
Yeah, similar industries, particularly falls, forklifts. And don't forget the work-related suicides, which for us is an issue with the football, where 80% of players can acquire a brain injury. And we know the number of suicides from AFL players. And in my view, they're work-related suicides, and we need to be paying attention to that. And also the farm industry, because we're currently supporting a number of farmers where they've had fatalities on their properties.
You're on Stick Together, Worker Stories, Union News and Social Justice Issues.
And that was Annie from 3CR Stick Together, an incredible and important interview that they had at the International Workers' Memorial Day held on Tuesday, the 28th of April. And you can always catch Stick Together every Wednesday from 8:30 to 9 a.m. And we will be right back with what we spoke about today.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. And we've had a really important show focused on protecting our NDIS. And a really, I know it's not an easy show to listen to and can be distressing. So the support is always available. You can call 13YARN for MOB, that's 139276, as well as a suicide callback service on 1300 659 467, as well as Griefline 1300 845 745, Monday to Friday business hours, and 12 to 6 on the weekend. Balila, what did we speak about today?
Yeah, so First up, we were lucky enough to be joined by Rhys Howard, Strategy and Policy Director for the First Peoples Disability Network, or FPDN. This morning, Rhys helped us unpack how exclusion by design of First Nations people with disability in the latest 2026-27 federal budget increases barriers to support for First Nations people, and also really reiterated FPDN's urgent call for culturally safe systems that have been validated and designed by community.
Following that, we spoke to Nick Rose, co-founder and executive director of Sustain. That is a network of citizen farmers, researchers, policy experts, and community connectors. He shed light on the sold-out Victorian Food Policy Forum and what was discussed, as well as key findings and recommendations that they found in their April 2026 Australian Food Security Pulse Check Survey. And then we very quickly touched on how food insecurity impacts those who are marginalised on multiple fronts, including disability communities.
And then you had my two-part interview with Andrew Bredleton, who's a disability advocate from Protect Our NDIS NAM, who joined me to discuss the importance of the NDIS, the devastating impact that these proposed cuts will have on participants, loved ones, community and broader society, and the upcoming government submissions deadline. Again, this has been extended to Monday, the 1st of June, before 5 p.m. We'll have information in our show notes on how to make a submission. But it literally just had to be a sentence or so, encourage others to do it. And yeah, it's really important that we get our submissions out there.
Finally, we played a segment from 3CR's wonderful Stick Together show on International Workers' Memorial Day, where Annie attended an event that was held on Tuesday, the 28th of April, 2026, and spoke about the passing of workers who had died from related injuries and got their very important stories around their experiences.
Thank you so much for listening to a very important show, and nothing about us without us. Thanks for listening. Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.